Epilogue. Angkor. Forgetting and Remembering. The great limestone terraces and tiered towers of Angkor Wat comprise the largest religious edifice in the world, a universe in stone, evoking eternity even as it seems to crumble into jungle. Yet the legends say it was built in one night. At the command of Indra, the Hindu thunder god, a heavenly architect presided. Nagas showed the workers where to find gold, pearls, and precious stones to line the walls. Magical servants of the god, called Devati and Devi, lifted the giant limestone blocks into place. Their fingerprints are still there, the people say. Look, our guide Yosha points out the perfectly rounded holes left by the fingers of angels. 29-year-old Yosha first entered Angkor Wat in 1989. It was on the Khmer New Year's Day, April 14. I came with my parents for the celebration of the pagoda, he says in his soft British-accented English, each word stretching as if it is melting in the heat. At that time, he said, the temple was very quiet, and the jungle looked very secret. Inside, very quiet, more than I can say. I envied him that quiet. Angkor now receives more than 250,000 visitors a year, making Cambodia's Siem Reap an international tourist destination. How did it feel to be alone in the temple, I wondered. Yosha, looking studious and thoughtful in his wire-rimmed glasses, paused for a moment. His words came slow and deliberate as a sleepy carp moving in a still pool. I felt very, very great, he said. How can my ancestors build such a temple as big as this? But the fingerprints of angels are not the only holes in the walls of this greatest of Khmer temples. I was particularly eager to see the carvings of beautiful celestial nymphs called apsaras. There are more than 1,500 of them lining the walls of just one gallery, each unique in her face and dress and posture, poised forever in a single gesture of her dance of timeless joy. The first one I examined was at the edge of a doorway to the west entrance. Between her upturned hand and her tilted head was a 2-inch crater. It had been made by a bullet. On my fourth journey to Southeast Asia, I have come to a vandalized temple to try to reconcile opposites. After 2 years of travels with a scientist, I have come to this desecrated but still holy place to contemplate beginnings and endings, animals and people, science and story, heaven and earth. Yosha grew up a few miles from Angkor in the same district. When he was young, his mother eagerly awaited the eclipse. In the dark of the moon, the most auspicious time for her prayer, she would splash him with water, tap his chest 3 times, and utter her deepest wish for her son. Don't grow tall. The tallest boys she knew would be taken first for the Khmer Rouge army. Yosha did not grow tall, but still he was taken away in 1985. The genocidal army in which he was forced to fight had already desecrated the nation's greatest temples. In 1971, Khmer Rouge guerrillas occupied the temples of Angkor. They lit fires in the galleries, looted its treasures, decapitated statues, and sold the heads on the black market to finance the war. They were not the first, nor the last, to sack the place. We soon saw that Angkor Wat's gallery of 1,000 Buddhas has scarcely a handful left. Long ago they were stolen away, by the Chams of what is now Vietnam, by the Siamese of what is now Thailand, in a series of sieges that preceded the mysterious abandonment of the entire city of Angkor in 1431, to be embraced by jungle until its rediscovery a century ago. Yet, even now, the looting hasn't ceased. You can buy pieces of Angkor's gods on any day from Bangkok antique dealers. Many of the stalwart lions guarding the entrance of Angkor Wat have no faces. None still have their tails. They remind me of the crippled moon bear at Lak Sao, of Matala the elephant with her 3 remaining feet. Few of the freestanding statues here have heads. Buddhas, apsaras, nagas, kings, and gods have been torn from the walls and pedestals, some by vandals, some by soldiers, some by collectors, some by time. And yet, the historians tell us, when Angkor Wat was built at the command of King Suryavarman II in the first half of the 12th century, it was dedicated to the Hindu god Vishnu, the preserver. He is the one who ordered creation, who maintains and organizes heaven and earth. Yet the preserver himself constantly changes form. Often he is shown in a human shape, but with four arms. Sometimes he is lying on a nada, the grand serpent of time. But in the great cycles of eternity, he has also appeared in the form of animals, a turtle, a fish, a wild boar. In one incarnation, the god was an ordinary shepherd. Inside the entry tower of Angkor Wat, he assumes yet another shape. His ancient stone torso is now topped with a new head, that of Buddha, to whom the temple was rededicated by subsequent kings. In his new incarnation, he is still adored. Incense smolders at his feet, fruits and flowers ripen into decay. And throughout the temple, at all times of day, we would find, to our astonishment, monks in saffron robes and nuns with shaved scalps carefully tending headless Buddhas. The decapitated statues clothed magnificently in saffron silk, their stone feet perfumed with offerings of incense, fruit, and flowers. With Yosha, I, too, lit candles at their feet. Hope, horror, avarice, blessing, the stark disjunctures so evident at Angkor, wrote the author of one guidebook, are almost too sharp to countenance. But that is precisely why I have come here. Ostensibly, I'm still looking for bears. While Gary teaches his spring courses at Northwestern, my companion, Diane Taylor Snow, and I scour the temple galleries for ursine images. We find apsaras, crocodiles, deer, birds, three-headed elephants, winged bird monsters, monkey princes, fish, trees, chariots, demons, but no bears. I inquire after live bears in the area. People have brought bears here for sale on temple grounds. A few years back, I was told, one person was hawking a moon bear cub like a postcard vendor, asking the equivalent of $200. We found there was a sun bear in captivity nearby to amuse guests at a hotel. But what I am really looking for is something else. For millennia, bears have been honored as teachers of healing, revered as symbols of resurrection, deified as the goddess who cradles rebirth. And this is what brings me to this temple. What I am really looking for is redemption. The scientific studies we began here in Cambodia have produced a wealth of new information. Gary's work has brought to global notice a beautiful bear no one knew existed before. Not only is the golden color form new to science, so are the panda-like variants and the brown color phases among the spectrum. As I wander the maze of Angkor's stone courtyards and galleries, a scientific paper listing Sun Yen and me as co-authors is in press at the Natural History Bulletin of the Siam Society. And although the DNA sequencing on some of the samples will not be yet done for months, much later we will find it to reveal more than a dozen distinct haplotypes. These fall into four major lineages, which will begin to reveal the outlines of the refuges that may have harbored them during the last glaciation. As for a third species of bear, proof of its existence is still outstanding. The DNA data will provide some valuable leads. It could still be out there, awaiting discovery. So productive has been our work, and so promising its many leads, that Gary intends to focus on the zoology of Southeast Asia for the rest of his professional career. But despite the satisfaction of such scientific success, my heart is haunted with memories. The 9-hour motorcycle ride through the Cardamom Wilderness, when every animal we saw was dead. The bears confined to tiny cages in Phnom Penh and the Elephant Mountains. The markets with their live and dead illegal wildlife. The trucks full of severed tree trunks. The starving animals in the zoo owned by the wealthy logging corporation. The Tien reduced to one last book only two people could read. When Gary and I began our quest, it was our fervent hope that our work would help save Southeast Asia's bears and forests at a critical turning point in the area's history. Today, the peoples of these nations will decide the fate of war's unexpected boon, the survival of some of the largest, richest, and most pristine forests in this part of the world. Now at peace, will the people be able to forge a prosperity that does not rape their precious wilderness, eradicate their rare and beautiful animals, erase unique cultures like the Chen? Even among the markets chocked with corpses of endangered animals and mountains laced with landmines, there are reasons for hope. Smart, scrupulous, and motivated people like Sun Hyun and Prechar Ratanaporn in positions of power in their nation's government. Prechar has, in fact, received a promotion to head the Thai Royal Forest Department's Wildlife Conservation Division, which we hope will hasten plans to restore moon bears to Thailand's national parks. Non-governmental organizations like Gary Van Zylen's TSCWA and Hunter Weiler's Fauna and Flora International and Cat Action Treasury, accomplishing the humane and conservation work for which governments can't or won't pay. Foreign scholars and researchers who, like Gary and myself, hope to contribute to worldwide efforts to preserve the gems of Southeast Asia's natural heritage. Even more influential than government or science, Buddhism's deep roots in the region hold hope for developing a humane and ecologically sustainable economy. Its temples have long served as sanctuaries for animals and as nurseries for trees. Teaching nonviolence, respect for all living creatures, and control of craving or desire, Buddhism presents its cool joyfulness as an alternative to the hot happiness so popular in the Western world. As the participants who gathered for a regional seminar toward an environmental ethic in Southeast Asia held in Cambodia in 1997 pointed out, Buddhism offers a model for development. The Dalai Lama calls it a compassionate economy, based on need, not want, and on reverence and gratitude toward humans, animals, and nature. And finally, there is the miracle of Angkor itself. Though a contemporary of Chart, Angkor Wat is more than a gathering place for the faithful. It was built, École Française Khmer scholar Claude Jacques tells us, as a palace to call a god to earth, an earthly model of a cosmic world built not merely to depict, but to materialize the divine. Even Cambodians themselves were at first incredulous to learn that their ancestors built Angkor. After its ruins were discovered in the jungle, explorers speculated on who could have created such splendor. Indians, many scholars thought, for some of the inscriptions on the stone are Sanskrit. Others thought it was the Chinese. Portuguese and Spanish explorers, who had glimpsed the ruins before Henri Mahout popularized their majesty in 1860, suggested Alexander the Great, or the Romans, or the Jews. But today, there is no question. The credit for the splendor of Angkor belongs to the people of a nation now crippled, lawless, and impoverished. People who, remembering their ancient reverence for life, now face the opportunity to show the world the way to a new and compassionate economy, a new way to call heaven to earth. But even here, in this holy of holies, rings the siren song of consumption. Yosha, like his country, has embarked in peacetime on a new beginning. Today, his focus is on learning better English, to become a better tour guide and earn a better living. Each week, he invests a precious dollar of his salary in English lessons with a tutor. He's even learned a song in English. At our request, he sang it to us. O Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Before entering Angkor Wat for the last time, we noticed a large tree on the southwest lawn. A huge welcoming creature, its trunk 30 feet around, it bears the heart-shaped leaves of the bo, the species of ficus beneath which the Buddha attained enlightenment. The tree is a hub of life. Large red ants course along scent trails like platelets in blood vessels seen under a microscope. 4-foot-tall brown termite nests stand like the temple's sentinel lions at the tree's base. Birds twitter hidden among the spreading branches. And looking closely, we see that the tree is not one, but two. Another species of ficus, having landed as a seed perhaps a century ago, is spreading its great spotted roots down over the bow trunk, enveloping its hosts, embracing the old with the new. At the tree's base, someone has erected 2 crude miniature shrines. Both were made out of square tins for cooking oil, one side of each bent to create peaked roofs. Each shrine shelters an altar made of a single brick, in front of which people make offerings to the spirits that live here. In front of the spirit house is a can that once held sardines, anchoring a bristle of spent incense, probably burned that morning. "I wonder who is the spirit that lives here," I say aloud. "I wonder if the spirits will survive this strange new materialistic age, and if they do, if the people will remember how to listen. I wonder if, as Gary suspects, golden bears can be found throughout Southeast Asia, and if so, whether the last of them will be doomed to die in zoos. I wonder whether an unknown species of bear really is still out there in the unexplored forests, and if there is, whether it will survive to be discovered." Just then, a rare breeze stirs the heart-shaped leaves of the bow. "It's talking to you," says Diane. Struggling with hope and despair, caught in the mystery of eternity and the unknown of tomorrow, I strain to understand that whispered answer.